Hi, Jim. Hi, Bob. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. It's nice to be on Blogging Heads with one of the original Big Cheese founders of Blogging Heads.
Yeah, you know what the other one's doing.
I heard. Tell me about that.
Mickey Kouse is making a bid for a Senate seat.
That's the U.S. Senate now.
That would be the U.S. Senate, yes. He was in student body government in high school. I think that was his last successful experience in politics. He was president of the student body at Beverly Hills High, I believe.
Wow.
But, yeah, this is the actual U.S. Senate.
Wow. And who's he running against?
I think that would be Barbara Boxer. Is that right?
Wow. The three-term incumbent.
Yeah. I don't know what all I know is what I read in the blogs. I found out about this while traveling. I just flew in from Arizona last night, which explains why I'm going to let you do all the talking, because I'm jet-lagged. And I haven't had a chance to talk to him about this. It does explain some of his recent behavior, that he was clearly working on some sort of secret project, and now I know what it was. What's your reaction to this?
Well, I am a big fan of Mickey Kouse. I think he's a brilliant analyst. I think his book, The End of Equality, 20 years ago, had a huge effect on me in terms of my thinking. Mm-hmm. I think he's fearless. Pardon?
Fearless?
Fearless, intellectually fearless. I don't know.
He does have intellectual courage. I have to concede that.
I will. I think he'd be infinitely superior to Barbara Boxer, but I also think that to run in California statewide is a $10 or $20 million operation just to sort of get started, and I will be curious as to how he does on that score of putting together a genuine political operation.
It could be that he's angling for some sort of Blogging Heads revenue split, and then he would use his half of it to finance that campaign, but maybe not. The question, and again, I've been asking him yet, is what is his actual aspiration? I gather in the Huffington Post, he said that it isn't so much about a serious expectation of winning as to, I guess, air some issues. I mean, I don't think it's at like a Pat Paulson level of frivolity, if you're old enough to remember Pat Paulson.
I am.
Okay, so for younger viewers, he was on the Smothers Brothers show, and he had this running gag of running for president, and he looked like just the last guy who could possibly be president. But that was kind of just a satire of the electoral system, almost, or the kinds of the whole process. I mean, Mickey wants to, I don't think it's a joke. I think he wants to advance some issues, right?
I hope so. I haven't talked to him either. It certainly seems to me that in as the Democratic Party has moved from sort of the Franklin Roosevelt, Harry Truman Democratic Party to the George McGovern, Barack Obama Democratic Party, they've lost what used to be a majority and a good chunk of the country. I think the Democrats have done something wrong. I think that probably Mickey Kouse would agree with that without saying that he agrees with everything I say, but the point is that he would say there's something gone wrong with the Democratic Party when it comes to issues like standards and kind of a no-nonsense approach to crime and welfare and social welfare spending and so on. It was the Democratic Party and the country were better off with a harder-nosed approach to these things, a kind of a tough love when it comes to running schools and so on.
In the case of welfare, though, they actually did follow that philosophy, and the result was Clinton's welfare reform, right? Mickey played a kind of role in that. I mean, I think his book helped pave the way for that, actually.
I agree with that, but I suspect, I confess I didn't check, I'll bet you anything Barbara Boxer voted against it in 1996. Now, you say it's a moot point now, 15 years later, but as we look at the chaos in the schools, look at the chaos in, frankly, much of our society, you could say that we need a lot more than welfare reform if we're going to get our cities back together again, not to mention get our economy turned around.
So what else are you saying you think you and Mickey might agree on? You guys agree on immigration?
I think we agree on immigration, as in restrict. Yeah, I'm sure you do. Restrict the border, assuming. politics hasn't changed him on that.
Yeah.
I suspect we agree on infrastructure, on building things. I suspect we agree that public employee unions are not a positive force.
He's not very strongly pro-union, I'd say.
Yeah, with pro-union and pro-public employee union are slightly different things. I mean, it's one thing to be in a union. It's another thing to have a union plus civil service.
Right.
Plus the direct access to the politicians who are paying you. That becomes a sort of a weird kind of aristocracy where people who make $100,000 a year don't have to work very hard for the $100,000 a year. That's not the experience of most Americans, especially these days. So a no-nonsense Democratic Party that said, look, it's just stupid to allow that to happen, would be a huge difference from the Democratic Party of today. And actually be kind of scary to Republicans, because Republicans say, look, it's easy to beat liberals. It's hard to beat Roosevelt-Truman Democrats.
Mm-hmm. I think his criticism of unions extends beyond public sector unions, I think. But certainly, yeah, you two would agree there. He was, I believe, anti-bilingual education when that issue came to a head in California. But that's, I guess, not a big issue of contention now.
Right.
So I'll tell you, I envy him. I mean, if he does get to a point, if he can establish enough momentum so that things he says, like, get reported, so that people are just paying attention to his candidacy, that seems to me like it would be a blast. If you, on the one hand, were not really running to win, in other words, didn't feel compelled to make the compromises you have to make to win, but on the other hand had some attention. I mean, it's a little like Ron Paul, I guess, you know. You get to show up on TV and say what you think, whether or not it can get you elected. I think that would be a lot of fun. I wouldn't say exactly the things Mickey would say, but I would have a good time.
Yeah, I think, look, in a world now of communication, I mean, why not? I mean, if everybody can be on Facebook, why can't everybody run for Senate? I mean, it's the same,
right.
You know. I mean, it would be a good discussion. And I think that, look, what the California Democrats, I think, are in, if you look at the ruin of the public finances of California, I think we can sort of see the dead end of advanced blue state liberalism.
Mm-hmm.
And so who's going to, you know, Meg Whitman and all the, and, you know, Carly Fiorina and all the various Republicans running for office there, I'm sure, you know, say, look, bring Barbara Boxer on, because she's exactly the kind of problem that got us where we are. And
well, but the California
Boxer's the type who would barely deny that she was part of the problem.
The California fiscal disaster unfolded under a governor who's not a Democrat, and that wasn't so much Barbara Boxer's.
Well, the California fiscal disaster unfolded under Gray Davis, who was governor until 2003,
and then has continued to unfold
under Schwarzenegger. And I don't think anybody would, including Schwarzenegger's worst enemy, would say that Schwarzenegger controls things out there in California compared to the legislature. I mean, Schwarzenegger's power as a governor was broken in 2005 when they had those four referenda, you know, on public sector reform. I'm sure Mickey was probably for most, if not all, of those Schwarzenegger referendums, and they all got beat because the police union and the prison guards union and the teachers unions all got together and blocked them all, and that ended Schwarzenegger's any semblance of being an effective conservative voice in California state government.
Well, you clearly know more about this than I do, so we should change the subject. but it is, you know, it's funny. Mickey's been talking for some time about the party in a laptop. You know, now that it's related to what you were saying. You know, why? You know, if everybody can be on Facebook, why can't everybody run for Senate? Which, by the way, would be a good plank in his platform. If I'm elected Senate, all of you will be in the Senate. But it is. I'm trying to make a transition to Tea Partiers because I want to.
Well, let me make one transition before we get there, and that's we were going to talk about her later. Let's talk about her now. Is Diane Ravitch?
Okay, sure.
Diane Ravitch.
You want to give a little background?
Is a well-known educational observer, author, pundit. Started out as a Democrat. Maybe always was a Democrat, but she served as the Assistant Secretary of Education in the Bush 41 administration. Which is where I came to know her.
And he's been embraced by conservative educational reformers.
She was embraced
right?
by conservatives and supported much, not most, not probably not all, but much of the conservative agenda when it came to testing standards, charter schools, and so on. And there was an interesting article in the New York Times a couple days ago which took note of the fact that she has sort of changed her position on a lot of those issues. It's not that she's become a liberal. I mean, as I read the article, it didn't seem to me that she was now embracing multiculturalism and so on. But she was saying that No Child Left Behind and standards and testings and even charter schools were not the panacea that she had hoped they would be. And she said, and this is sort of where it did actually remind me of Mickey and his would-be campaign. What we need is, look, if you want to have good schools, what you need is to hire the best people in your country, pay them a lot of money, and have them be great teachers. And that is, there's a sort of a structural agnosticism there, who are they being hired by? Are they being hired by the state? Are they being hired by the private sector? Are they being hired by the Catholic Church or the Protestant Church or whoever? And what it struck me was she was kind of summoning up was the kind of system that they have in, say, Europe, where the public school teachers are much more respected and much more serious, and it's like in Germany, for example, it's kind of a mix of public and private. But the common thread running through those school systems is no nonsense. You're not free to wear a T-shirt that says something offensive or obscene. You have to study your Latin and your mathematics and so on. And I guess, as I interpreted what Diane was saying, and I'm sure she'd be thrilled to be on Blogging Heads, so she'll get a chance to speak for herself to your viewers, is that, look, no nonsense is no nonsense. That's what really matters. And testing, where they spend the entire year teaching to the test, isn't really the answer. What you need is just good schools and firm discipline all the way through. And I would imagine that Mickey would be substantially in tune with that, and I wouldn't be in the least surprised to hear him sort of saying, look, the issue isn't some, Cato Institute theory about, privatization. The issue is, how do we get good teachers in there? Now, that actually is kind of, that statement, how do we get good teachers into the schools without regard to public or private, is in many ways kind of a threat to both the liberal establishment and the conservative establishment. The liberal establishment wants the exact same school teachers, never get fired, no matter how bad they are. And the conservative establishment wants to basically plow under the entire public school system and make it private. And so somebody says, actually, I want to take the public system and reform it, is sort of a threat to both left and right.
Yeah, but Jim, you were talking about structural agnosticism. And that's where kind of the rub is. I mean... In other words, it's not enough to say, okay, you can fire bad teachers. It has to be the case that the person in charge of hiring them has good judgment. And having sent kids through the public school system, I can tell you the principal makes all the difference in the world. I mean, where I live, we have what is reputed to be a very good public school system. But the teachers at the elementary school were, I thought, pound for pound, much better than the teachers at the junior high school. And it's all, the answer is clear. The principals. The principal of the elementary school is great at hiring teachers. The principal at the junior high school was not. I'm not sure how long he had been doing the hiring, but, there's a lot of things you can do if you're sure that the decisions will be made wisely and the money will be well spent. You can raise teacher salaries, and you should. You can at least limit, you can constrain tenure and so on. Although I also think there's a case for not having teachers live in fear, beyond a certain point of being fired any given year. But anyway, the problem is how do you make sure the person doing the hiring is doing a good job?
Well, I mean, I think one answer, which is, again, the European tradition, is, look, we've just, for centuries, we've been having qualified people become principals, and they do a good job, and they have both experience and authority and credibility, and they can't be sued by the ACLU for the decision they make, and this seems to have worked out reasonably well. So when I say structural agnosticism, I don't mean to exclude the principles from that structure. I'm saying right. that the finance when I said structural agnosticism is referring more to the financing. Is it public? Is it private? Is it some independent thing? Who knows
she
what?
She is structurally agnostic. Well, but I mean, in a different sense, which is that it's easy to say we need better teachers, but what is the structure that is going to bring that? Now, one thing she was saying is that these things like charter schools that we thought were going to provide an alternative public model and kind of put pressure on the other public schools to do a better job, she thinks they haven't worked. She also thinks teaching or standardized testing hasn't worked. And here, I'm totally on board with her. I mean, for a couple of reasons. First of all, the No Child Left Behind deal, where administrators have an incentive to increase test scores. Well, first of all, test scores have so much to do with demographic trends. I mean, not just the demography you've got, but changes in demography over time, over which the principal has no control. You know, if a neighborhood gentrifies, its test scores are going to go up. It has nothing to do with what the administrator is doing. The other thing about testing is, you know, you see how an intense emphasis on test scores, what a dispiriting effect it has on the best teachers in the system. And I've seen this in the high school. You go here, and there's some really good teachers, and they are being forced, under somewhat different incentive structure, but they are being forced to teach to the AP test, okay? And you can see that, by and large, the best ones don't like it. They think it's not leading to the best education. I don't know. It's just, at the same time, tests should play some role in evaluation. Students who graduate from high school should have some minimal set of skills, but I'm on board with Diane Ravitch to that extent.
Right, and there's also the other element, which is there are probably too many people being run through the academic curriculum as opposed to the technical school curriculum.
This is something that changed another
kind of European idea that doesn't really fit either the liberal left or the conservative right. And that is, and it's not necessarily cheaper, by the way, to send some kid to learn how to become a mechanic or, of some sort of craftsman. It might be expensive as all get out, but it might still be worth it because we're getting a skilled worker, which is something that most people say this country is in short supply.
I mean, one reason there's less of that is done in America than used to be done, that sort of tracking, is that, the fear was that you give a student a test, or at age 13 or something, they're forced onto one track or another, and then it's either blue collar or white collar. That question is determined for them, and there's no turning back. I mean, that was the concern.
I think the answer, of course, is it is being determined. We're just doing it at 17, not 13. So what difference does it make?
Well, it makes difference in the sense that it's clear, the truth is clearer at 17 than 13, I think.
Well, the point is that it probably still is true at 13. We just don't acknowledge. We spend 4 years teaching the kid or trying to get the kid to learn, AP something or other.
I agree filling classes with students who just don't want to learn, is all the students pay a price for that. I mean, the aversion to tracking goes beyond the vocational academic track. I mean, for example, for some reason I don't comprehend it's considered okay to do tracking in math but not in, English. And are you aware of that? I mean, that's a common thing in schools.
No.
I guess because math is considered more meritocratic or something. But so you'll have these English classes that include a number of students who just are not interested in learning, and it holds everybody back. From the New York Times article, I didn't get a clear idea of what Diane Ravitch thinks we should do now that this stuff has failed.
I think what she said was what works is excellent teachers, excellent schools.
Well, great.
It does have implications for both. If one were to sort of adduce what she's saying, you say, okay, maybe we have to pay them more, but we also can't have a union, and we also can't have the ACLU and trial lawyers sort of riding herd over the system. That might or might not, but that would be my guess as to what she's sort of was driving at.
One thing that I would say that I think is you would sign on to is that, and this is in a way a critique of overemphasis on standardized testing as a panacea, especially in low-income areas. In extremely low-income areas, what I think is often the bar to vocational achievement for students is no more academic education than it is the mere possession of what you could almost call social skills. The skills that are required to deal with customers well and so on. And I think the kinds of schools that you would like to see set up would do a better job of instilling those than are sometimes done.
Or just outright apprenticeships. Look, you're going to be in the hospitality industry, and so why don't you start working in the hospitality industry?
Yeah, that could probably make sense.
Exactly. So anyway, I mean, it's interesting. We sort of both were struck by that Diane Ravitch article. It will be interesting to see whether Mickey picks up on any of what Diane is now saying.
Well, Mickey, but I think Mickey's critique tends to stop with teachers' unions get in the way, which I do think they sometimes do. But I'm here to tell you that it's not an easy answer. How you solve the problem once they get out of the way. Once it's easier to fire and hire teachers, then the principal is in control. And I'm telling you, I have seen, even in affluent areas in the public schools, some really bad principals. So that alone doesn't solve the problem.
Okay.
But I would also, of course, say, I would like to see a lot more. I realize there's no point in throwing bad money after good or spending money in a wasteful way, but I do think in the long run there's an urgent need for more federal money in lower income educational areas.
There could be, but what you can't have, of course, is the current crop of teachers who have SAT scores below the national average becoming our teachers.
But that has to do with things like salaries, which cost money, and intangible ways of conferring prestige on teaching as well.
Like you can't get beat up by your students.
That would be good.
Right. And you also have to build discipline in the class. I mean, Philip Howard, has written, a number of very thoughtful books on these sorts of issues and said, look, if the teachers spend half of their time disciplining students and they have to discipline them the right way because they're worried about being sued, then you've got a problem. Any good teacher will quit before spending his or her career just chasing around with disciplinary procedures and rules and regulations. This is the Howard argument, which I haven't heard anybody even try to refute. They just simply say, well, gee, we can't do anything about it. Well, if you can't do anything about it, then we're not going to have good schools, period.
Okay, so we'll wait for Mickey to solve that problem and several others. What do you want to talk about, health care?
Sure, let's talk about health care.
I admire Obama's persistence, I gotta say. He's not letting go of this thing. Most people I hear talk about this who know more than I seem to think the odds are against him. But what's your take?
I agree they're against him. I mean, this is what's today, March 3rd, I guess. This last night in the news, there was somebody, Chris Matthews or somebody, was saying, Democratic strategists I talk to say it's 50-50. And whenever I've lived in Washington long enough to know whenever I hear 50-50, that means you're cooked. Because 50-50 is kind of what
cooked?
You're cooked. When the proponents say 50-50, that means the proponents think they're cooked.
Whoever is saying 50-50 is whistling in the dark.
I think so.
Okay.
Never say never. We've both been around politics long enough to know that the slam dunk of one day is the opposite the next day. It does happen. I mean, what is so striking to me, though, is why Obama, and for that matter the Democrats, have chosen to cling to a political model of health care that the American people clearly don't like.
Now tell me, what is your model? I mean, to the extent that I could discern this from listening to you talk to David Korn, your approach to health care reform would be to celebrate the glories of the free enterprise system something?
No, my approach to health care is to celebrate the glories of cures. I don't think I've said the free enterprise system once. What I've said is that if
Obama's not anti-cure,
I'm sorry?
Obama is not anti-cure.
I'm not aware that he's doing anything that makes him pro-cure. And I think
so
also that the influence of the trial lawyers, again, has pretty much guaranteed that for every one step forward we make on medical progress in terms of science and cures, we're going to take half a step backward.
Because of malpractice?
Not just because of malpractice, but because the essence of improvement in any system is feedback. Okay, if you and I are working at a factory and we say, you know, that assembly line batch went by, but there were too many of the widgets were cracked or discolored or whatever it is, we get with Dr. Deming and have a conversation in our little quality circle about it, and we talk about what we learned. And we try and do better the next day, and the next day, and the next day, and the next day. That's what Dr. Deming, who's now, of course, passed away, called continuous improvement. And it sounds sort of simple until you really focus on trying to do it, as you know, companies have and have not over the last few decades. It's quality control. There's a million different names for it. And if you are afraid to say what you learn from a given medical procedure, because you know what you say, either in person or even worse on a computer record, can and will be used against you by John Edwards, then you clam up. And so the whole scientific enterprise of the free sharing of information closes down.
So
that's the real danger, the real knife in the heart of the forward propulsion of scientific inquiry. It has nothing to do with free enterprise. It's just people are saying, look, if I admit that I don't think that really worked out that well, or that patient didn't look so good, or I was a little hungover when I worked on him, or whatever,
you think if it weren't for the threat of malpractice, doctors would be saying, listen, I'm sorry your spouse died, but I was a little hungover and I just didn't get the job done?
No, the doctor would never admit that to the patient's widow or widower.
Right.
What he would say is to his fellow patients, you know, I think that next time we should
next
spend
time
more
time. Next time I should drink less?
No, we should spend. We should
drink less before treating them?
Look, in other words, Bob, don't be fun. Say to yourself, how do factories get better? You know, there wasn't something quite right about that batch when I went out the door. You know, we're breaking too many things or something like that. But every one of those admissions about a widget, nobody cares about. Well, you blew a widget. But the point is, if you hurt a patient, you get sued. And you never get the kind of feedback.
Well, I would say two things. I mean, first of all, the reason people don't share their blunders with the world, I think, has to do with human nature. And
I'm not saying blunders with the world. I'm saying blunders with colleagues.
Well, in my experience, people are loath to admit their blunders even to colleagues, leave aside financial incentives. Humans just tend not to do that. But the other thing I'd say is I think you have to admit that the threat of lawsuit can deter malpractice in some case. It can make people more careful.
I'm sure it can, but the point, what my original point was that if everything is suable, then you won't get the most precious thing in scientific inquiry, which is a mistake that you learn from. The mistake that you learn from is precious.
I can see that you've isolated one downside of heavy, heavy penalties for screwing up is that people will be even more reluctant to admit error than they were anyway. I just think they would have been anyway.
They will be unable. Look, the history of science proves that people over the thousands of years or hundreds of years of real empirical science have said, look, you know, my idea is better than your idea, and the other guy says eventually, yeah, you're right, you have a better idea. But if that becomes a legally actionable term to say, well, yeah, you're right, I did screw that up, I could have done better, then you don't say it, and everybody, it becomes like a giant East Germany where everybody's careful what they say. So that I'm not saying that's the only issue facing us. I'm saying it's a huge issue that Obama has completely left.
I don't think it's that huge.
I challenge you to think. Bob, you've done a lot more writing about science than I have. And learned a lot more about it. And science comes, whether it's nuclear physics or biology.
Let me draw on that wealth of knowledge and say that actually you're wrong in something you just said, which is the way science works is somebody says, see, my theory's better, and the other guy says, oh, you're right, your theory's better. I mean, studies have actually shown that when whole new scientific paradigms come in, it isn't that the old school reconciles itself to the new paradigm, it's just that they finally die, and the younger scholars who grew up with the new paradigm usher it in. So it's just, that's just another example of how reluctant people are to admit error.
You're right. I mean, that's actually that's the argument that Kuhn made. You have to the old paradigm doesn't die, doesn't change the mind, they die.
Right.
But when Alexander Fleming said, you know, this thing penicillin might be a good idea. You know, somebody else who was working on something else had to. Again, there's a process there where people say, you know, he has a better idea.
Uh-huh.
And that process has to be, you know, given all the stipulations about the stubbornness of human nature, the unwillingness to make mistakes, the unwillingness to lose face, that has nothing to do with losing money in a lawsuit or getting fired.
Mm-hmm.
It still means that we've had a slow motion choking of medical science because of the threat of lawsuits. And I think that's very clear. I think it is not really if some exotic new drug is invented and put in the market, and then 0.1% of the people who take it get an adverse reaction or a heart attack or something like that.
Uh-huh.
You know, in our current system, that means that the drug gets yanked from the market, and there's never any time to really sit and think whether, you know, Avandi or Vioxx or whatever the, you know, controversial drug is, and you know, is actually worth it for 99.9% of the patients.
Yeah.
It's the 0.1% that get the whole drug yanked. If we're moving in a world of personalized medicine where the pharmaceutical companies or the government or whoever's running this system says, you know, look, a certain percentage of the population with whatever genetic predisposition they might have or a weight issue or another drug interaction they might have, if they take this drug, they'll be in trouble. Now, you can't let the wings of the bell curve decide the central thrust of your policy on this.
No, I mean,
and that's what the trial lawyers have done to the FDA and to the political culture.
I think politics has done that to the FDA to some extent. But look, I agree that as a society we are too risk averse. Now there may be a cure for that coming in the doing DNA kind of fingerprinting for everybody will tell us which part of the population is at risk for a Vioxx induced heart attack or whatever.
Right, exactly.
That problem may solve itself.
But that requires infinite regressions of data to figure out, okay, who's actually riskier? Is it because they're old or because they have a certain blood type or a certain genetic
disease?
Yeah, but
those regressions are happening. Those studies will happen. The pharmaceutical companies are doing them and funding them in academia.
And then if a pharmaceutical company does a study and says, you know, look, we think that 0.2% of our population will be killed by this drug, that becomes discoverable to some trial lawyer, and so they don't write it down.
I'm just saying that before long it may be that they can say, we think the 0.2% that will get killed is the percent that has this variation of this gene, and we'll give you a test before we give you the medicine, and then everything will be fine.
Right, but if they write down, we think it's 0.2%, but then it turns out to be 0.3%.
Yeah.
Then the trial lawyers say, look, you admitted that people would die from this, but you just didn't care about this extra population you didn't know about. Everything becomes evidence that can and will be used against you. If you and I had this conversation, 0.2% will die. Well, okay, Bob and Jim agree, well, that's an acceptable loss. But then we understood, Bob and Jim just admitted on Blogging Heads TV that it was dangerous, so you knew that and you went ahead anyway. What a slam dunk for John Edwards down the road somewhere.
Well, again, I think once you can isolate the genes that segregate
but the point
the
is,
population.
Bob, again, but anyway, you don't know that a priori. You speculate on that, but you don't know it.
How directly responsive your perspective is to what a lot of people think is the problem with healthcare, which is that, I mean, you're saying you could reduce the cost of healthcare to some extent if trial lawyers weren't so powerful, right?
Right. That's one answer, yes.
Okay, that would be not...
Another answer would be to actually cure the diseases that are so expensive.
Well, right. But here, I mean...
For example, Bob, if Alzheimer's, for example, is projected to quadruple in the next 40 years, how should we go about bending the curve on Alzheimer's? Should we say to you and me as aging boomers, you know, look, when the Peterson Foundation gets done fixing Medicare entitlement spending the way it wants to, are they going to cut us back to two meals a day? Are they going to change our bedpans once every 3 days? How are they going to go about cutting spending on you and me if we are unlucky enough to have Alzheimer's? Or would we say, You know, it would be cheaper if we just went to work on curing Alzheimer's, or at least figuring out how to delay the onset of Alzheimer's. Because you and I plan to live to be 100, and we hope that we don't spend the last 30 years of that or 20 years of that in a state of dementia. The federal government in 1950 projected...
Okay, can I just interrupt and say I think there's a connection between these two things that you're not maybe you don't agree with me that it exists, but you're saying you're afraid that they're going to focus on cutting costs by changing my bedpan only three times once every 3 days. I want to go on record as being against changing my bedpan only one times every 3 days. Okay. But you're worried that they'll cut costs that way, and that will somehow take resources away from seeking cures or something.
I'm worried they'll cut costs that way, which of course will never actually happen, because the public will never allow.
Over my dead body,
and mine too, and we all fight for our families and something like that. So in talking about cutting costs, they never actually cut costs. All they do is kill the environment for future research. So, for example, in the middle of this big...
How does it kill the environment for future research to change my bedpan less often, Jim?
No, the killing the environment for future research is the fact that we spent the last year arguing about healthcare reform and healthcare insurance and not talking about curing these things. And meanwhile, in the middle of this big...
You don't have to talk about it. The pharmaceutical companies are busy doing it right now.
But they're not doing it. They are not. I mean, look, there's been virtually no progress in Alzheimer's in decades.
Well, it's a very difficult problem.
I know it is.
I mean,
but,
and it's
AIDS was a very difficult problem, and we had a cure in 6 years.
Yeah, but that's a conventionally virally transmitted disease. Alzheimer's is something more complicated.
You figure it out.
Well,
that's the point. Look, in 1938, the United States said we want to cure polio.
Mm-hmm.
And 17 years later, they had the vaccine. That was a crash course.
Yeah, but that's, again, another conventionally transmitted a neurodegenerative disease of this sort is subtler. But look, there's a whole issue here that you tend not to address, and that I think maybe undermines some of your emphasis on bigger, better medical science and more effective medical cures. And it's this, okay? One thing that all of this impressive medical progress has been made, which I think it is impressive, one thing that has done is it has created more and more situations where you can pay a lot of money to get somebody a relatively marginal benefit, so that there may be a test that, you know, I may have a tiny percentage chance of getting cancer, but there's a test that costs a fair amount of money that will tell me for sure whether I have it, okay? That's a marginal benefit, statistically speaking, at a great cost. Or these things that increase life at the end of our lives, and that seems to be what you're interested in, when we are old and infirm and life doesn't have the quality it does anyway, and at great, great cost, you can extend people's lives like a few days, okay? There are all these... It is an inevitable product of medical progress that you get these high-cost, relatively low-benefit things, okay? Now, if the government is going to be in the business of providing health insurance, and you've got to face it, it already is with Medicare and Medicaid, and certainly to the extent that it's going to increase the number of people whom it's helping to buy to pay for health insurance, then... You've got to draw the line somewhere, right? I mean, I'm talking as a taxpayer here. I am happy to see my tax dollars go to provide health care insurance for people who don't have it at all at low income, at low levels of income, for example. But I am not willing as a taxpayer to see my dollars spent on these things that cost a whole lot and bring relatively meager benefit, okay? And this means that inexorably we confront what could be described as the issue of rationing. In other words, you have to draw the line somewhere and say, to the extent that government is paying for this, it won't pay for this. Now, people with whom you're associated, Jim, I don't know whether you have yourself bought into this language, have characterized this as a pro-death panel position, the idea that there should be any lines drawn at all. But what I want to say is the necessity of drawing lines is imposed on us by the combination of medical progress that leads costly, low-yield benefits, A, and B, the government being in the healthcare insurance business, which it already is.
Now, you might be referring to Medicare, for example?
Yes.
In this? Okay. Bob, what percentage of the GDP is Medicare right now?
I don't know.
I'll tell you. 3.2.
Okay, thank you.
3.2%.
Thank you. But,
is that
but
too much?
What bearing
is that,
does that have on the argument I'm making?
Well, the point is 3.2% of GDP for senior citizens' health care, including long-term care, like just like you were describing.
Yeah.
A per se outrageous amount.
I think it's a lot, actually.
Okay. I mean, it's 3.2% of GDP doesn't strike me as that much.
I mean, this is just for health care, you know. This isn't...
Right, okay. 3.2% of GDP on health care for senior citizens, by the way, is also 3.2% of GDP of wealth for somebody else.
But in any event, Jim, just as a matter of principle, wouldn't you agree that there is some limit? If the government is paying for insurance, paying for health care for senior citizens, there is some limit on bang per buck, or I should say buck per bang, right? You would agree with that, right?
I would, however...
Death panels!
I'm not sure that the American people will agree with you as to what that limit is anywhere close to where you had set it.
Well, that may or may not be true, but my point is when the main themes you focus on, which is, you know, get the trial lawyers out of this and onward with medical progress, I think there are significant issues that you're not addressing. In particular, what should health care reform look like, Jim? I mean, do you agree that more low-income citizens should be covered? I'm genuinely unclear on this. I don't get this from the stuff you say. So tell me, what form should health care reform take? Do you think everyone should be insured?
I support a universal mandate.
You do?
I do.
And you agree that there has to be some government subsidies with that, right? Especially
I do.
Okay,
I do.
So you favor the broad contours of Obamacare.
I favor the broad contours of a system where everybody's covered. However, it is also clear to me that the Obama people, for reasons, they would have to explain, aren't interested in medical research and they aren't interested in legal reform. And so they are dooming us to exactly what you, Bob, fear most, which is an open-ended entitlement with no hope for actually solving the problem. And as to illustrate exactly what I'm saying, within the last month, this is early March 2010, just a few weeks ago, the Social Security Administration just announced that it was opening up the speeding up and accelerating the process for approving Medicare payments to early onset Alzheimer's patients. Again, the only reason I knew about this was because I saw a full page ad in the Washington Post taken out by the Alzheimer's Association celebrating the fact that the Social Security Administration, which is a part of HHS, which is a part of the Obama administration, had agreed to this. So in the middle of all this discussion about bending the curve and cutting costs and rationing and all this kind of stuff, they just opened the spigot of future spending many, many billion dollars wider. And it wasn't even controversial. It didn't even get noted. It just
and you're,
was
and
so...
you're against it?
I'm just observing that... Again, the people who say, and again, I understand it's the dominant think tank pundit viewpoint that we've got to ration, we've got to restrict, we can't afford to spend all this money, are fooling themselves, and more to the point, they're sending the political class off to its termination in the next election every time they say, look, just be courageous, just be tough. You know, Pete Peterson and the Pew Foundation and the Center for Responsible Federal Budget all agree this is what you have to do. Now go out there and do it. Then the politicians get defeated. The think tank billionaires stay and continue to grind out position papers saying the exact same thing, and they never learn from the experience of both parties as they try and hack away at medical costs in a way that the American people who do own this country don't agree with. That's my point, is that if the establishment were as smart as the establishment likes to think that it is, it would say maybe the 1982, 1986, 1994, 2006, 2010 elections are telling us something.
So you're saying, among other things, that limiting medical malpractice is a more politically viable way to save money than some of the ways being tried.
I'm saying that a strategy of focusing on cures. Folks, some people say we should keep the system as it is, and other people say we should cure cancer. Which side are you on?
But, Jim, there's a huge amount of money that goes into finding cures.
Well, compared to what? We spent about $200 billion on the war on cancer since 1971.
Jim, I'll tell you something. Basic economic theory tells you that, if anything, we are overspending on cures for the following reason.
I'll tell you how.
If you look at the system, the process by which companies that find cures are paid for them, okay, it is mediated by health insurance. And health insurance, buffers, as you know, the recipients of the health care from the actual costs of the cures. I mean, I'm telling you, if what you pay for cancer treatment actually had to come out of your pocket directly in a discretionary way, okay, rather than it being the case that you've already got your health care insurance and you just know it's more or less paid for, then it would be less lucrative to find cancer care than it is.
Not under my system, because I'd give it away.
You'd give it away?
Sure. And you know what? If I gave enough of it away, it would get cheap. Just like a cell phone.
Give it away? You mean the government should pay for everyone's... So you're in favor of what?
Because we would then be creating an industry that we... So if we got a cancer drug that really worked...
Yeah.
We could give it away to Americans and sell it to the rest of the world. We'd be rich. We'd be like Kuwait.
Well, once you've got a drug, the cost of replicating it and mass producing it is trivial. But
exactly.
But you realize that if you win
the prize. That's exactly right.
Of course, but Jim, if you give it away to everyone, I mean, in order to pay for the research, if it's private sector research, you have to guarantee the people who find the cure some remuneration.
Look, when President Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, that is, decided he wanted to win World War II,
yeah,
he went to the Boeing Corporation and said, how much do you want for 30,000 B-17s? And Boeing gave him a number, and we got 30,000 B-17s in one World War II.
First of all...
And so it seems to me that if we thought it was important, if we cared about the health of the well-being, not just the life maintenance of our fellow citizens, we would say, listen, cancer is a terrible thing, and just like President Roosevelt wanted to cure polio, and just like activists wanted to cure AIDS, we think it's important we cure cancer. And we're going to create this giant medical industrial complex, and we're going to take a real stab at curing cancer.
Well, we should some things for us to pick up on in future conversations. We should move to some of the topics. One, I'm interested that actually you do accept some of the fundamental contours of Obamacare, universal mandate and government subsidy. I really didn't realize that, and that's that's interesting. Two, I would like to hear your response in the long run to my argument that actually, because of health insurance, we are devoting too much resources
to the development
of cures.
That's an interesting view. You're entitled to your opinion. I just don't think very many Americans agree with you.
I think it's Econ 101. Econ 101 professor agrees with me.
Maybe, but I didn't say Econ 101. I said most Americans.
I would rather have the esteem of America's Econ 101 professors, because I'm not running for office, Jim.
Bob, I fully understand that's the trap.
Right.
That the healthcare policy debate is in is run by people who would rather have the esteem of microeconomists or even macroeconomists than of the American people. The most cost beneficial thing to do from a strictly economic point of view with senior citizens is, you know what the answer is, it's death panels. It's put them on the ice floe.
You know,
and from an economic point of view, from a strictly Benthamite utilitarian point of view, that makes a certain grim sense. It just is politically catastrophic. As it should be, and also morally catastrophic, as I believe it is, and maybe even you believe it is. So we're stuck with the fact that we've got to do something, think of what to do with Vanny and Grandpa, and my answer is let's help them live longer and productive lives, maybe even work longer so they can raise retirement age as part of the grand bargain, and then create a medical industry that not only helps them and helps us, but then becomes an exporter to the world. That's kind of what we did with every other industry that's worth anything in this country, and I don't understand for the life of me why we don't apply it to medicine.
You know, speaking of healthcare, Jim, you know who could use some better medical care? This guy, this Hamas guy in this Dubai hotel. At the moment that the Mossad agents, and this is like segue of the year we're talking about. At the moment that the Mossad agent injected him with muscle relaxant in his thigh, he needed 911 at that point. They should have called 911 because the next thing they did was smother him. He needed medical intervention in between the muscle relaxant and the smothering, and he didn't get it. You know what? I have a theory. Have you seen the pictures of all the agents?
I have. I think so.
I think I know the one who administered the muscle relaxant. Have you seen that? There is one. There is mainly men. There's a couple of women. One of them is Hollywood beautiful. And having seen the movie Munich, have you seen Munich?
I have, yeah.
Which is about this whole Israeli policy of covert assassination. If the movie Munich is accurate about some of the MOs employed by Mossad, I think I know how they got into the hotel room and which person administered the muscle relaxant to his thigh.
Okay, could be. I did see Munich. I thought it was a very good movie.
I assume people know the background on this. It's gotten a lot of press. You know, apparently Mossad was caught red-handed this time, and European countries are upset because they used the real passports of real European citizens to sneak into Dubai and kill this Hamas guy and so on. What's your take on this?
I think that the cat and mouse game of counterterrorism is, you know, one that sort of an ongoing thing, and I can sort of see the argument. I think, however, I question the wisdom of killing this guy, this Hamas guy, in the Persian Gulf, in the shadow of Iran. I think that if the Israeli objective was to convince the Arabs that Iran was a greater threat to them, the Arabs, than Israel was, I think this assassination probably muddled that message.
The first question is assume you don't get caught. I mean, clearly this has been a big embarrassment, and they're paying a price for this of some intangible sort. But assume you don't get caught, is the policy effective? I think is an open question of itself. I mean, the thesis of the movie Munich is kind of, no, it's not effective. It's just an escalating tit for tat, and it makes you, if anything, less secure, but certainly not more secure. It seems to me, you know, there's two ways this can work, these assassinations. I mean, they can, in the short run, degrade the operational capabilities of Hamas, and then in the longer term, they can be a disincentive for people to accept high-ranking positions in Hamas if the chances are high enough that they'll get caught. I think the actual evidence on this is that this approach to fighting terrorist organizations is really not very effective to the extent that there's evidence. Certainly, I would say that, you know, Israel's been doing this for a long, long time now, and I do not see that there's been any great deterrent effect in terms of discouraging people from becoming leaders of terrorist organizations.
I suspect that the Israeli argument would be, look, we are causing mayhem and confusion in their ranks. We are setting Hamas against Fatah and Fatah against Hamas, and then we announced that, you know, one of the son of a leader of Hamas was actually an Israeli spy, and that'll send them all into, you know, frenzies of suspicion and finger pointing and so on and so on. So, I mean, I wouldn't minimize the sometime utility of, you know, the iron fist against your opponents. What I think should, the Israelis should not be confused about, though, is the inadvisability of having 2 or 3 million Palestinians in their country, under their occupation, or whatever you want to call it, in the West Bank and so on. So, I mean, and I just would point to what I was saying earlier, which is that at the same time all this is happening, it doesn't appear that the Arabs are convinced that Iran is a great threat to them. And then just, I guess it was just today that we saw that the Chinese have said no to more sanctions against Iran. And
well,
so
the conventional view, though, isn't it, is that actually leaders of Arab countries are plenty unhappy about Iran growing in power and influence, right? But that the Arab people, that to some extent Ahmadinejad has probably successfully rallied the Arab, some of the Arab people to his side, right? Isn't it kind of
I suspect that's probably true. I mean, but again, that's where assassinating some guy in a hotel and not seeming to be very careful about how they were doing it. I mean, 26 people, all of whom seemed to have been filmed on a myriad, you know, security cameras and so on. You know, that, I mean, it seems to me that this is a case where a tactic, wiping out one guy that in Hamas that at least, you know, you and I had never heard of, if
yeah.
You might be famous over there, but the tactic of this assassination seems to be in conflict with a larger strategy. You know, what Clausewitz would call, you know, the main effort, which was isolating Iran. And so, in that, like a lot of things in this world, you know, you can, you know, we had many operations in Vietnam or Iraq or Afghanistan where we succeeded in killing whoever the enemy was and then caused, you know, collateral damage among civilians or
yeah.
something. And, you know, those experiences often turned out to be negative.
Yeah, and in fact, this is very parallel to the quote, to the drone strike question in a way. In other words, how effective is it to wipe out, to assassinate these high-ranking terrorists, you know, as offset by the price you pay in some other realm? In the case of the drone strikes, one of the prices are the periodic civilian casualties.
Right. What most struck me about the maybe not the latest, but one of the recent drone strikes that seemed to have gone awry was, you know, we blew up a bus, you know, with 20 civilians in or something, and it was obviously a mistake, and the American government apologized, but General McChrystal, who I'm sure is a talented fellow, as a general, went on Afghan television to apologize for this happening. And guess what language he spoke in?
English.
English. And it kind of tells you everything you need to know about how serious America really is about its effort to transform Muslim countries. That after 9 years or whatever it's been now in Afghanistan, or 8.5 years. We still haven't figured out how to speak their language.
Mm-hmm.
I suspect that if the Pashtuns had come to Texas or and taken over and said, look, we're here to run things in a better way and liberate you from Rick Perry, but after 9 years they still hadn't bothered to learn English or Spanish mostly English. I don't think people in Laredo or Fort Bliss Fort Hood, would cotton to it very well. So in other words, maybe we're not doing a good job of being, you know, upset on our own terms. If we really had wanted this to happen, we would have said, look, you know, if the issue is hearts and minds, then, you know, all you 3 and 4 star generals, you know, need to learn the language.
Well, certainly, even just issuing a written apology in there, even if you had to learn it phonetically, you're probably right, that there would just be some value in seeming to make the effort.
Exactly. I mean, nobody. I'm sure your accent would be terrible, but at least you'd be trying.
Right. No, I think in most countries, France being the well-known exception, people are flattered if you at least try to speak their language and do so poorly.
Right. And so that's, again, you can have the best tactics in the world, you can have the best machinery in the world, and if you can't, again, as is Clausewitz again, the issue in fighting is you have to change your opponent's will to fight. As long as the opponent wants to fight you, you haven't won.
Yeah.
You may be winning, but you haven't won. So if you want to actually put this war to bed, you have to say, look, everybody, we agree we're not fighting anymore. You know, it doesn't have to be every last individual, but it has to be the country as a whole or the entity. And Something tells me that going back, and I don't mean to pick, again, it's not like this thing in Dubai is probably the biggest deal in the world. I think you and I have sort of always agreed that it was never really in the cards that the Iranians were going to, you know, accommodate the West, and it was never really in the cards that Russia and China were going to agree to some meaningful sanctions program.
I'm not sure the Iranian thing is beyond solution. I mean, I always thought in the, over the last couple of months that China was going to be a very, very tough sell on this, and I don't think sanctions ultimately is going to get the job done anyway. But what I mean, what is your view on what should be done in Iran?
Missile defense.
Missile defense, regional missile defense, then, which is what they're doing.
I hope so. I wish we would do it too. I wish everybody would do it. I think that I think Iran is going to be a nuclear power in 5 years, no matter what we do, including bombing them. Because I think they'll just get one somehow, or they'll get one from Pakistan, or they'll have one we don't know about, or something. I mean, the challenge we face is that it's just not that hard to build a nuclear weapon. There are probably 30 or 40 countries in the world that could do it pretty quickly, and the Iranians are going to proceed on this course to great powerdom, and our prudent strategy, and this is both Israel and America and other countries that don't like this, is strong defense. We've sort of had the experience of trying to change their government, and that didn't work out too well. And sanctions are probably more of an annoyance and, frankly, an aid to the current regime. If we think a country is a threat to us, we should defend ourselves against that country and have retaliation. I completely oppose this plan that Obama is supposed to be talking about reducing nuclear weapons. I think that's exactly the wrong way to go. But I would add on to a robust nuclear arsenal the ability to shoot down the other guy's weapons, and I would continue with research toward you know lasers and anything else, force fields beyond missiles shooting at missiles.
Yeah, I mean, so your hope would be that regional missile defense would deter reduce the incentive of Arab states to get involved in a regional arms race in nuclear weapons?
I think that, look, there's always going to be arms races. I mean, I think that, no doubt we're going to wake up and discover that Saudi Arabia just bought an A-bomb from somebody. No, the arms race, I think, look, arms races are endemic to, you know, great power, even small power rivalries. I mean, I'm sure the Arabs, in their heart of hearts, would love to see some kind of Arab NATO or Arab alliance or Arab nation or UMA or something like that. I don't think that we would be very keen to see 22 Arab countries unite into one. Mm-hmm. I'm sure they're thinking in terms of some sort of regional thing. So if we're going to preempt that unification of the Arabs, however, you know, notional and long-term it might be, then we should be talking about our own. So, look, we'll help you. We'll help defend you, Arab countries, defend Israel, defend Europe, defend ourselves with a multi-layered missile defense system that makes the fact that Iran most likely has nuclear weapons at least somewhat moot.
Yeah, I'm not willing to accept the inevitability of arms races in all realms, and one reason is just because I think the more countries that have nuclear weapons, the more likely, you know, in a kind of unmonitored way, especially, the more likely you are to wind up with non-state actors, as they say, in possession of them. And I think that's a bigger threat than nuclear war
right,
among
which,
nations.
Which is why I'm for Homeland Security, too.
Well, right, but that doesn't, you know, Homeland Security just ain't going to do the job. We disagree on what's adequate and what's not. I having just just flown in from Arizona, I've had about enough Homeland Security as I need.
But again, we have the wrong kind of Homeland Security. I mean,
yeah.
Bob, you know, I don't think you're a terrorist, and I think the TSA ought to know that.
Well, right, but now we get into. I mean, we don't have time to, as usual, we don't have time to pursue all the fascinating strands our discussion leads to. But you're probably going to say you would be in favor of ethnic profiling at airports.
I'm in favor of terrorist profiling.
which would involve focusing on ethnicity.
Again, it's Diane Ravitch. I'm sure would say, look, if you want good teachers, you want good schools, you get good teachers. If you want good Homeland Security, you get good Homeland Securitizers. You get people who know what they're doing, like the El Al people and so on, and they're good at it. They take it seriously. It's like a West Point for Homeland Security because they care about this. Anything that you want to work well, whether it's Homeland Security or healthcare or education, has to be done with people with expertise, prestige, and esprit. If you don't have that, you can have any system you want. It still won't work.
We can end on this agreement in favor of competence as a governing principle in the world, if nothing else. But we're over an hour, so I guess we should stop. It's too bad. I could have argued like all day on several of these fronts. And I think I hope I don't leave the impression that I'm acquiescing in the various outrageous things you've said.
Just I hope you don't leave the impression you're chickening out from a fight. Okay, I hate to think that.
No, bring it on. I mean, we should let's make a date, like in a month or so. Let's come back and do this again.
All right, very good.
Okay.
Nice talking to you.
All right. See you, Jim.